Welcome to the April Fool's edition of Political Rewind. It's 3:06 on a Friday afternoon. I have a group of people in this room right now who don't have a single prank to play on anyone this April Fool's Day. Everything you hear today will be serious and sober-minded.
We are the fools.
Jim Galloway, the political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read his column every Thursday and Sunday in the newspaper, the Dead Tree Edition, and he oversees Political Insider, the online blog that keeps you up to date every day, hour by hour, about what's happening in politics. Todd Rehm, Republican political consultant and the editor of his own blog, GeorgiaPundit.com, where you can not only find interesting information about what's going on in politics currently, but also see the adoptable dogs that Todd has made it his business to try to get adopted out. And it's really kind of heartwarming to look at his blog for that. Former Congressman Buddy Darden joins us again, Democrat from Cobb County. It's always a pleasure to have you here. Buddy, thanks for being with us.
A recovering politician.
And Dr. Joseph Crispino, the Jimmy Carter Professor of American History and Southern History at Emory University. I got that title absolutely correct?
That's right on.
All right, Absolutely. Terrific. We're going to get to all of the things that we talked about in the opening of the show. We're going to talk about historical precedents for what we're seeing going on right now. We're going to talk about Donald Trump, his comments about abortion. We'll talk a little bit about the Hillary Clinton-Bernie Sanders battle. But, you know, this has been a really important week in Georgia politics. I think you could say historic in some ways. On Monday morning, the governor vetoed the religious liberty bill, and we've all been watching the fallout and what we expect next ever since. And we're getting today a little preview of a column that Jim Galloway has been working on this morning and this afternoon for the Sunday paper, which relates to a part of what the governor had to say. And Jim, before we give you an opportunity to give us this preview of your column, let's listen to the lines from the governor's speech that are pertinent to your column.
In light of our history, I find it somewhat ironic that some in the religious community today feel that it is necessary for government to confer upon them certain rights and protections. If indeed our religious liberty is conferred upon us by God and not by man-made government, perhaps we should simply heed the hands-off admonition of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. When legislative bodies attempt to do otherwise, the inclusions and omissions in their statutes can lead to discrimination, even though it may be totally unintentional.
You know, Jim, and I know you've this is the basis for your whole column. That's the sort of language you might have heard in a debate that the founding fathers were having about the role of God, about destiny, about all of those things as they debated the founding of this country.
That was old school Baptist. That was Danbury Baptist. That was Jefferson and the Wall of Separation Baptist.
Well, explain that a little bit.
And the Baptists were kind of began in the late 18th, early 19th century as kind of the dissident sect, Christian sect in America. And the one thing they did not trust was government. They wanted nothing to do with government. They didn't want to be regulated by government. They didn't want to. They didn't want any kind of anything that established them as a part of government. And we have just been over the last three or four decades. We've been through a fight within the Southern Baptist community over just that. I started covering it when I first came to the AJC. It was it began in the early 1980s. It continued maybe through 2000, and it pitted the fundamentalists versus the moderates. It was over biblical illiteracy and such. But at the heart of it, it was about the denomination's attitude toward government.
Yeah. Going back even further, Jim, as you recall, the Rhode Island delegates would not sign the Constitution until it had a Bill of Rights attached to it, which guaranteed freedom of religion. That was Roger Williams. And the Baptists. And that goes all the way back, that the Baptists were the ones who really championed the wall of separation.
So how do you apply this in terms of the column you've written for that we'll all get to read Sunday?
The fight over religious liberty in the state capitol has primarily been a Southern Baptist fight. They've been the backers of this initiative. And in Georgia, they're the Georgia Baptist Mission Board. Okay,
the
conservative branch. The Catholics have bowed out of it. The Methodists have bowed out of the fight. It's just the Southern Baptist. Well, the governor vetoed it, and the governor used to be a Southern Baptist, but he's not anymore. He is a part of the Cooperative Baptist Fellowship. The part that split off from the Southern Baptist Church because they thought it was wandering into theologically dangerous territory. They were getting away from that Jeffersonian tradition.
So Joe Crispino, I think what Jim Galloway's pointing out is fascinating because essentially you can look at this in terms of Baptists and the split in terms of philosophy about government, but it also is in some ways goes to the heart of the philosophy of the Republican Party, doesn't it? Less government is better government. That's essentially also what Governor Deal, in this case, that may not have been the basis on which he made his veto, but it certainly applies that the governor's saying, too much government, let's let the Constitution do its job.
Well, right, you can let the First Amendment do it, because the First Amendment has the protection right there. But Jim's talking about a really interesting thing. The first Supreme Court ruling on school prayer, many Southern Baptists were not opposed to it at all because it was separating the church from the state. And that had been a central tenet of the faith throughout, going back to the origins of the faith in the 18th century and their first experience with the government. So, yes, you're right. The relationship, the kind of evolution of the Southern Baptist in their relationship to government is really something that's happened in a novel way in the last three decades.
Yeah, Jim, so people can read your whole column on Sunday, of course, but go ahead and finish. You know, make the point that you really want to make, and then we'll talk about this veto and what's happened since then.
Well, it's just, I think this pretty much wraps it up. I mean, this fight is going to continue. There's not going to be an override of the governor's veto. We know that. But they are going to go back to the issue when the legislature comes back in January. And basically what they're going to be faced with are two Baptist standards of religious liberty.
Interesting.
And they're going to have to choose between the two.
Todd, we did learn, as Jim points out yesterday, there had been questions about if there was going to be an override, a special session. Certainly the governor wasn't going to call it. It would have to come from the leadership in the House and Senate. And yesterday, both Casey Cagle, Lieutenant Governor, and Speaker David Ralston said, we're not doing it. We have no interest in having a special session on this, right?
That's true. But I think that if I were the governor of this state, I might be concerned that the leader of the House and the leader of the Senate are spending any time speaking to each other, because what I think we've seen this session is the beginning of a turf battle and a beginning of a push to see who's going to lead the state in the last years of Nathan Deal's last term in office. That's a structural issue within most forms of American government, but we're really going to see that in action. And for the last few years, most of the rivalry has been between the Senate and the House. And it looks like what we're going to see next year is going to be more rivalry between the legislative and the executive.
Buddy, I learned something in listening to you and Jim Galloway as we were sitting here waiting for the show to go on the air. And that is that there has been talk that maybe that there would be an effort in the regular session that starts in January to override the veto before moving on to the introduction of a new version of the religious liberty bill. But procedurally, this has to happen right away. Is that correct?
That is correct. That has to be the first order of business for the new legislature when it comes into business to consider the governor's past vetoes. And let me also take this opportunity to commend Jim for pointing out that Reverend Bill Coates of the First Baptist Church in Gainesville, Governor Deal's minister, is one of the most respected members of the clergy in North Georgia. And I think he probably, by example, not by word or influence, but by example to Governor Deal, was probably a key factor in this decision.
All right, before we get off that real quickly, Jim, we don't really know how they're going to maneuver yet. The legislator's leadership is still trying to figure this all out. But we are more likely, don't you think, to see a new version of the Religious Liberty Bill with a lot of conversation over the summer among the parties, including perhaps the governor?
Well, I think that would be one tack that could be taken. I mean, the governor could step out and say, this is precisely the bill that I want, and you can either take it up and pass it, and I will sign it, or I will veto the next one, too.
Todd, what are you hearing from the Republicans downtown that you talked to?
Well, I haven't been downtown in several days. I've been out in the suburbs where most of the action is going to be taking place in campaigns this election. But I can tell you that for the folks who have been pushing this, there is no diminishment of their desire to do this. And what I think you also have is an increasing concern among the cultural conservatives in the General Assembly that time is running out for cultural conservative control of Georgia government, and that's part of what's behind this. We didn't do it 30 years ago when it would have been easy, but this might be the last chance you ever get to have anything like this passed. And so I think the fact that you had a gubernatorial veto probably makes it stiffens the character of some of these folks.
One of the last chances, because the demographics of the state is changing and we're not likely to continue to elect such conservative members. Is that the reason behind that?
Not that the Republicans who do get elected are going to be any less conservative. It's that we're not going to see a supermajority last very long into the future.
Right. Joe's nodding in the same way about this.
And in order for the cultural conservatives to drag along some of the suburbanites and some of the inside the perimeter less conservative Republicans, you need those overwhelming numbers to pass something.
Right, right. Okay, before we get away from the legislature, Buddy Darden, the governor has another big, big decision ahead of him with probably, if not the same kind of pressure, enormous pressure on both sides facing him in terms of campus carry. That bill still sits on his desk. There is a philosophy. There, one take on this is he can't possibly veto two bills that are so popular with the conservative base. The other argument is that he asked them to make changes in that bill, and they defied him.
He gave them fair warning. In fact, he even sent over a bill that he would approve with certain provisions in it which were more acceptable to him. And the problem that Governor Deal has is that this Board of Regents and this president of the University of Georgia and so many of the people now in the education establishment who are opposed to this bill, he supported their appointment, or at least he approved only tacitly, their approval to where they are. And now these are Deal people who are saying, we don't want this. However, some of the same people who are mad at him on the religious freedom are the very same crowd that are mad at him probably if he vetoes campus carry. So I don't see a downside if he goes ahead and bites a bullet and does it.
Oh, he's already got him angry enough. Huh?
No, well, I will tell you what. I mean, he's got enough resistance on university campuses and on the Board of Regents and such. I have begun to wonder how you start to implement this. What the bureaucracy response will be?
Yeah, Joe, your Emory University, of course, is not involved in this. It's a private university that applies to public universities. But you work on a college campus every single day, and I assume there have been conversations about this bill and what its impact could be.
Well, yeah. I mean, colleagues I talk to, talk about how if the legislator doesn't want guns in the state house in their workplace, there shouldn't be guns in my classroom. And that's the sentiment for a lot of, faculty members that I know and that I talk to.
Todd, is there a downside? If the governor vetoes these two major red meat issues for the conservative base, are they going to take it out on him when he tries to do education reform, when he tries to redo the quality basic education funding formula, which he has said for several sessions now is one of the most important items on his agenda.
That's an interesting question. When I started out in professional politics in the 1990s, it was an article of faith among Republicans that one of the things you were campaigning for if you were running for state legislature was to reform QBE. It's been thought to be a horrible situation for that many years. I think there are going to be a lot of, particularly your suburban legislators, who will go along with the reform for QBE if it's the right thing to do for education.
Regardless. In other words, it's not going to turn into petty politics.
I don't think there's going to be hostage taking. I don't think there's going to be hostage taking in that respect. But here's something that just occurred to me is, if I were one of those legislators that felt I had the overwhelming numbers, what I might come back with on religious liberty the next session is a constitutional amendment, which does not require the governor's signature and goes directly to the voters and would go directly to the voters in 2018, which is a gubernatorial election year. That's what I would do.
Or couldn't you just pass a civil rights statute that declared a protection for people who are not currently protected under any state statute, say gays and lesbians? Wouldn't that be another way you could do this?
I don't see that happening.
We've wandered back into the religious liberty territory
here.
But I will tell you, one thing that the governor might be considering is he's not going to get a veto override over religious liberty. But he might over campus carry.
Right. Interesting. All right. You're right, Jim. We've gone off the rails. We're now circling around, chasing our tails. So let's do this. Let's take a break at 3:22 on Friday afternoon. And, you know, when we come back, you've never seen ever a candidate for president like Donald Trump, right? Well, maybe you have. We'll talk about it in a minute.
Can we shorten GPB's spring membership campaign by reaching the goal early? Let's find out. The more listeners we hear from before the drive starts, the sooner we'll get there. So don't wait to support the programs you love on GPB. Go to gpb.org right now and click donate. You'll also have a chance to win a St. Simon's Island getaway for two at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort with oceanfront accommodations for three nights, golf, and more. That's gpb.org, and thanks for your support.
Texas singer Maren Morris came into her own as a songwriter in Nashville.
At the time, I didn't consider myself an artist, but with that song, it all changed. Can I get a
hallelujah? Now her next album is one of country's most anticipated debuts. Hear why later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 until 7 on your GPB station.
Sounded good, didn't it? I want to listen to more of that record. We're back on Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut, along with former Congressman Buddy Darden, Jim Galloway of the AJC, Todd Rehm of GeorgiaPundit.com, and Dr. Joseph Crispino from Emory University. So, Joe Crispino, I said to you the other day, let's look back on some of the races that do have some strong parallels to what's happening now, perhaps so we don't feel so alone out in the wilderness with right. What's going on right now. Let's talk and let's listen to a clip first about 1968 when George Wallace ran as an independent, right?
His popularity is a river fed by many streams of discontent. It is wider than the race issue and broader than a Southern movement. His support comes from people who are angry about a lot of things.
He's, I don't know how to put it, he's got guts, let's put it that way. That's about the best way I know on it. The man has got guts enough to stand up against all kinds of criticism. And maybe he's not a politician, but that's in his favor as far as I'm concerned, because I'm not either.
So that was an NBC News, NBC TV report about the Wallace campaign in 1968. Joe, is it correct to draw some parallels between Trump and George Wallace?
Oh, sure. Sure. If you look, just look at the campaign rallies that we've seen recently. I mean, we have not seen that kind of violence, that kind of vituperation coming out of the crowds, you know, since 1968. And also how Trump responds to the crowds, how he feeds off it in the same way that Wallace used to feed off those crowds and stoke those crowds and really kind of tap into the id of the masses there in the way he handles those gatherings.
Of course, in 68, he launched an independent bid For the White House, correct?
Well, sure. Yeah. I mean, Wallace ran as a third-party candidate. He'd run in the Democratic primary in 1964 and did surprisingly well, right? And first kind of demonstrated the power of a kind of reactionary vote there in 1964, which was the year of great liberal accomplishments legislatively. 4 years later, he runs as a third-party candidate, and he pulls off votes both from the Democrats and the Republicans that year, pulls off those working-class white Southern voters.
The hard hats.
Well, the hard hats, and I shouldn't say just Southern voters, right? Because in 64, he was in Maryland, he was in Milwaukee, he was in Gary, Indiana. Those were all the places, the hard hats.
And Michigan.
In Michigan, absolutely.
Are these essentially the same kind of voters that Trump is attracting right now? That's what I hear.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're exactly the kinds of white working class folks who feel like the world is leaving them behind. The world is changing in dramatic ways, and there's nobody in either party who's speaking to their concerns. That's what the Wallace voters were throughout the 60s and 70s, and Trump is speaking to them now.
You talk about the crowds and the way in which a Trump today, George Wallace then, responded, especially to protesters. We've seen the kind of violence and offensive language that he's used on protesters. We have two clips of George Wallace dealing with protesters at his rallies as he was running for president. Let's listen to the first of them.
You've got some folks out here who know a lot of four-letter words, but there are two four-letter words they don't know. WORK and SOAP, you don't know those two-letter words, I'll tell you that much.
Todd, you know, one of the things that we talked about this off air, there are similarities, but Wallace was really quick-witted, and in some ways, he was a little smarter in how he went after. I mean, Trump's just kind of, it all comes flowing out, and, you know, it doesn't necessarily make a whole lot of sense. Wallace knew how to talk to a crowd.
Well, and he also came up in a culture where speaking in front of these large crowds was his bread and butter for however many years he had been in public life. And nowadays, you don't give speeches. You give a 3-minute talk in front of people. You don't get on a stage and speak. And so that type of presentation is not, it's not something that most politicians learn today. But what Trump has learned and what we have seen is this way of exaggerating everything to make real mundane life more interesting, to make the ongoing stuff of hiring and firing people dramatic.
Right,
so, and so he has brought that reality TV aesthetic to the stage now.
Joe, I want to ask Joe.
Mm-hmm.
How would have George Wallace have done on Twitter?
That's a great question.
Well, I want to ask Buddy because, you know, George Wallace was trained in this Southern tradition of the stump where you were skilled on the stump and you go through that warfare. And you're exactly right, Todd. I mean, Donald Trump's training is in the world of reality television. And but Wallace had skills in stoking that audience. I mean, you must have seen plenty of those kinds of rallies.
I have, and I remember many, many times going to Marvin Griffin rallies. However, the reality TV of today is the old crowds of yesteryear. And Donald Trump brings to this campaign a unique quality that has not been seen since Dwight Eisenhower ran for president, in that when he came onto the scene as a candidate, he was generally well known probably than anybody out in America other than the political established figures. So he already had name identity. People knew who he was, and they had a certain comfort level with him, had an opinion on him.
But I was going to say, just to actually answer your question, Jim, I think Wallace would have done well with Twitter, because Wallace did well with the other new form of technology, which was television. And a lot of those Southern governors, those Southern segregationists, couldn't translate to use the medium of television. But Wallace would go up to New York and go onto the Sunday morning talk shows and hold his own against, you know, liberal newspaper reporters who were interviewing him. He was quick-witted, and he could speak in sound bites.
There is a video on YouTube, and Jenny, maybe we can find it and post it on the Political Rewind website. After one of the more violent confrontations, it might have been Selma, although I'm I think that might have been too early, actually. Forget it. There was a violent conflict clash. There were police beatings of civil rights marchers. Wallace went to New York, as you're saying, on Face the Nation, and he brought with him newspaper articles, front pages showing similar things happening in New York, in New Jersey, photographs of New York police going after demonstrators, anti-war demonstrators. And frankly, it was a very effective rebuttal to what he was being accused of as a Southern governor.
Yeah, well, this is what Southerners have been doing since the 40s, right? Saying, well, you've got your problems, too. You've got your problems, too, rather than actually trying to address the problems.
Oh, sure. I'm not trying to defend him.
No, absolutely.
He was clever.
But yeah, I mean, and that's the thing, is that the racial problems of those era were never just regional. And that was the only real response Southerners had.
So you talked, I want to play another clip, because you talked about the fact that another similarity between these two is the way in which they sort of talk about violence against the people who are out in the crowd. And here's a remarkable example of that with George Wallace. It may be a little bit hard to quite understand it, but we'll do our best. You'll hear how he threatens demonstrators in general.
If you'll elect me the president, I come to Arkansas, and some of them lie down in front of my automobile. It'll be the last one they'll ever want to lie down in front.
Buddy, that's actually one of his most infamous comments during his presidential campaign.
I love it. I love it.
You love it.
It reminds me so much of Donald Trump up there these days when he's having these protesters come against him. But I will say this. So just here lately, I think the empire is striking back. I see the Republican establishment and the media, the two groups that he has attacked the most vociferously now, seem to have united against him and are really making life miserable for him.
Joe, we haven't talked about demagoguery. We haven't talked about Trump as a demagogue. We haven't talked about Wallace as a demagogue. Is it fair to lump Donald Trump into that category with some of the demagogues of American politics?
Well, I think when you have that incredible microphone in front of you and you are appealing to the baser instinct of those voters, sure, you can talk about demagoguery. That's exactly what Trump was doing. And in that clip you showed from Wallace, which is kind of chilling when you start to think about these leaders who have such influence, subtly, comically invoking violence. It becomes chilling very quickly.
Joe, if you could, just for people out there, what's your academic definition of a demagogue? Why is Obama not a demagogue? Why is Donald Trump a demagogue? Why is George Wallace a demagogue?
Well, because in some ways the point of democracy is appeal to the people, right? To get to the support of the people. But the demagogue is that, you know, there's always been a tension in our political tradition between, you know, mobocracy and democracy. And I think the demagogue, I mean, to take it back to, it's a word that comes out of the Greeks, but the demagogue is the appeal to the mob, the appeal to the base instincts, the instincts that divide and that polarize the population.
Todd Rehm, I want to, well, before we go on to another race, 72 is another race that you suggest we could look at when George Wallace once again mounted a campaign for president.
Well, it's true. I mean, there's never direct parallels. History is always, there's similarities and differences. But one of the things I think we forget about 72 is that Wallace was winning. You know, Wallace, there was going to be a big fight in the Democratic convention in 72 had Wallace not been shot. He was shot on May 15th, 1972 in Maryland. He had to drop out temporarily. He dropped out of the race. It changed his political career forever. But I don't know that he would have won the nomination in 72, but he won Florida. He won some important states. He won Tennessee. And it would have been a real battle there in the even more eventful than it was. The Democratic Convention was pretty eventful in 72 as it was.
You just reminded me, too, that he was a big factor in statewide elections in Georgia around that time. In fact, Senator Sam Nunn criticized Carl Sanders, or at least David Gambrell or somebody, for not bringing him over. No, Jimmy Carter.
Jimmy Carter. That was the Jimmy Carter
Jimmy
race
Carter,
since 1970.
You're right. Jimmy Carter in 1970 criticized Carl Sanders for not inviting George Wallace to speak to the Georgia legislature. And 2 years later, Sam Nunn goes over to Alabama to seek the endorsement of George Wallace.
Todd, I think that we should say that when we talk about demagogues, the South has no specific and particular claim on demagoguery. Joe McCarthy, Wisconsin senator, fits into that category as well, clearly.
Yeah, and I think that it's one of the universal character types of people who get drawn to politics. There is always, I say that when people ask me what it's like working with politicians, I say, you know, you meet a lot of great people. There is in every one of them some level of altruism and some level of self-interest, and it's a question of the balancing. And what you see in your classic demagogues is somebody who feeds off the emotion of the crowd. And for whatever reason, that also makes them effective in driving the emotions of the crowd. It's a fascinating dynamic.
All right, so let's look at another race. We're looking ahead to July in Cleveland at the possibility of a divided convention, of no one coming in with enough delegates to claim the nomination. Trump may be close. Who knows? We'll see what happens in Wisconsin and then moving forward. And it reminds me, Joe Crispino, that the last time that we went into a convention with this uncertainty was the Republican convention in Kansas City in 1976, set up who that race was, who was contesting it.
Well, you had a sitting, one of the things that was so dramatic about 1976 is you had a sitting president, Gerald Ford, who was being challenged for the nomination by Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan, who had exploded on the national scene in 1964 when Laid and Barry Goldwater's campaign, he gives this nationally televised address where he seems to be able to articulate conservative principles in so much more reasonable way than the candidate Barry Goldwater himself did. Goes on to win the governorship of California twice and is the voice and the embodiment of the conservative political cause that had been germinating in the Republican Party for decades.
And he's running against a president who had not been elected.
Who
had never been elected. That's right.
Who had taken the office after, of course, the resignation of Richard Nixon. So what I had forgotten about was just how wildly popular Ronald Reagan was within the party. I think the final delegate count put him very close to almost seizing the nomination away from Ford. A couple hundred delegates at the most, something like that. You don't happen to know, do you?
I don't know the exact numbers.
Nevertheless, Reagan had already shown that he had an appeal to the Republican base that was overwhelming. I want to play another clip from NBC News. To set this up, the nomination has now been settled. Ford will be the nominee, but the Reagan forces at the convention are still longing for their man, Ronald Reagan, which could be a situation we'll see in Cleveland this summer with Donald Trump. Who knows? And we're going to hear on the final night of the convention, when Ford is going to give his acceptance speech, a clip in which we hear that Betty Ford is about to enter the arena, and Ronald and Nancy Reagan are, by coincidence, coming in at the same time.
It'll be interesting to see if Mrs. Ford enters the hall, because everybody in this auditorium, 2,259 delegates, a lot of alternates, everybody in the audience is standing and applauding the Reagan box. Nobody is looking the other way.
Mrs. Ford is not coming in now, we understand. She'll come in at some appropriate time later.
Those delegates who are still chanting for in honor of Governor Reagan, they're asking them to sit down. They won't.
I'm Tom Pettit in the Ohio delegation with Governor James Rhodes. Governor, you've been talking about inviting Governor Reagan to speak from this platform tonight. That's all.
I think he should be here. He's a very popular candidate, and I think he has high principles and great concepts, and I think he should speak from the platform tonight, the same as President Ford and Vice President Dole. I think they all ought to be here. And I think the broad view here in the spectrum of the political body, that everybody that wants to speak, that in Reagan's class should say something to all of us. And I think we're looking for unity, And the way to get unity is invite everybody.
So, Jim Galloway, that could be a scenario that we see. That demonstration was 12 minutes long for Ronald Reagan. They would not sit down.
Yeah, but who's going to be doing the cheering and who's going to be trying to work their way up on the stage?
Well, right.
I mean, is it going to be a Trump rebellion or a rebellion against Trump? I just don't know.
I don't either. What's interesting, too, as I listen to that, is you think about Reagan narrowly losing the nomination in 76 and then winning in 80, right? And the thing that's different about Reagan is that he really he was the face of this organized political philosophy, you know, this faction that had been trying to take over the party, you know, for two decades. And Trump doesn't. I mean, I don't know. It'd be interesting to hear Todd's take on this, but you know, Trump doesn't really. It's not organized at all. It's this thing that's kind of grown up out of frustration, and I don't think it's going. Will it last beyond this election cycle?
No, I think this is entirely driven by the individual candidate. Now, if he were to continue in politics beyond this summer, then it'll last as long as he does. But it's not something that I think there's no heir apparent to it. There's no organization. I think really over the last 3 or 4 weeks, you've seen them scrambling on a nationwide basis to build an organization behind them, which is something I've never seen. And that's not the kind of movement that lasts.
I would certainly defer to Todd on any issue of Republican politics, but it's apparent to me that the party machinery certainly is not behind Donald Trump, and the party machinery is going to determine who is at that convention to a great extent by the rules they pass. And while they won't be able to keep all the Trump delegates out, anybody who's up for grabs won't be Trump delegates, in my opinion.
Well, I think Buddy's absolutely correct. And I think this is something that I've been saying since we first started talking here on Fridays about Donald Trump is that, you know, I trust the voters and I trust the electorate of the Republican Party that nominated George W. Bush and McCain and Romney, that they're not going to make it easy for Trump. The word Byzantine means something for a reason. You come upon these big structures and they are difficult to deal with. And it's putting a lot of lawyers to work, keeping a lot of Buddy's colleagues awake late at night, trying to figure out how to do things in a convention that has not been in a system that has not seen a contested convention in my political career.
Right. I mean, to Todd's point, Donald Trump, of course, met with the RNC this week in Washington. And there's some New York Times reports out there that are on the wire right now saying that basically he is conceding that his people haven't done the job that they ought to have done in protecting the delegates that they win in these primaries.
Yeah, he was complaining very specifically about the way in which the Cruz people were able to pick off Louisiana delegates and complaining about the party. And Reince Priebus said, that's on the organization of the campaigns.
Right. And apparently Trump conceded that, yes, this was so.
Yeah. One other quick little tidbit about that 76 convention, because, Buddy, you talked about rules. There was a rules fight that the Reagan people initiated because they tried to pass a resolution, a change in the rules, that would have required the presidential candidate to name his running mate. And they wanted to do that because they thought if they could force Ford to make a decision ahead of the vote, he would alienate at least one part of the party and give votes to Reagan. So rules changes played a role in that convention the way they could this summer.
Yeah, I mean, there were a ton of backdoor meetings and that were taking in place in Kansas City all during that time. And what's crazy to imagine is to have a brokered convention in Cleveland in which, at least in 76, you could have a private meeting and you could more or less control what's coming out of it. How are you going to get any deal made at a convention when everyone is live tweeting what's going on in the meeting? I mean, it's going to be absolutely madness.
All right. So one other quick note before we get off the 76 convention. Here's another thing I thought about as I listened to that, Todd. We're not going to take the time there. Gerald Ford did invite Ronald Reagan to come to the podium and give what were supposedly impromptu remarks at the last minute because he recognized the convention loved Reagan so much. So they did come together. there you had a situation in which all parties, to one extent or another, were in the mainstream. They were regular Republicans, so they could find unity. That is not the likely scenario for Cleveland this summer, is it?
No, and I think you've got to add to it the level of personal animosity that has developed that does not lend itself to statesperson-like coming together at the end, and the fact that they're going to be fighting every day and every night during that convention. I don't think there's I'm not holding my breath for that to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
I want to ask Todd a question and see if he remembers. Who was Reagan's choice for running mate? Hint, he was a senator from the state of Pennsylvania and a somewhat liberal senator.
Was it Schweiker?
You're absolutely Lowell right. Schweiker?
Man, you know what? These Emory graduates, Joe Crispino, your folks teach him well at Emory University.
So proud, Todd. So proud.
For those of you all scoring at home, that's 3 points on the board.
All right. Very quickly, because we're running out of time for this, but Joe, just for a couple minutes, there's a parallel that we could see also develop this summer to the 1924 Democratic Convention in New York City. Do you want to just quickly talk about what happened in that convention? That went to 103 ballots.
Right, 103 ballots in 1924. William McAdoo, who was born in Marietta, Georgia, was the leading candidate coming in, and he had been worked in the Wilson administration. But I mean, you know, this was the days of the Democratic Party when Will Rogers famously said, "I'm not a member of any organized political party. I'm a Democrat." Right? I mean, the party was deeply split between North and South, East and West, between the prohibitionists and the supporters of alcohol. McAdoo comes in. He actually has the support of the Ku Klux Klan, which in 1924, of course, headquartered right here in Atlanta, but it was a national organization that had strength outside the region, across the country. The Klan were big supporters of McAdoo. Al Smith, the governor of New York, gets involved and runs just to try to stop McAdoo. There's 103 ballots. Eventually, John W. Davis of West Virginia emerges as a compromise candidate.
Yeah, now we're not likely to go to 103.
Let's hope not.
the hotel reservations don't stretch that long.
Well, in fact, it's funny you say that because that's what was happening in New York City that summer. That it stretched on and on. I can't remember how many weeks the convention lasted.
I'm quite serious about this. Randy Evans, the RNC member from Georgia, has told us that's their big fear, is that this convention could stretch beyond their lease on the arena where they're going to be meeting.
Right, right. Okay, fascinating. All right, look. What we're definitely not going to get a chance to do is go back to like around 1830, Joe Crispino, to the split between the Democratic Party, the Andrew Jackson Democratic Party, and the Whigs, because there too was a major difference in philosophy that led to the starting of the founding of an entire new party, right?
Yeah, I think American politics is too much of an mature industry to kind of see a real party split. I think the Republicans are going to hold together. But that is what happened with the Whigs. I mean, the Whigs started to, because they were opposed to Andrew Jackson. They called him King Andrew. And that was a time in the world when there were still kings. You know, that was just, you know, kings weren't just somebody who showed up on, you know, celebrity magazines. They had power. And it was the scene that, you know, Andrew Jackson was opposed to social economic progress. And that's how the Whig Party started. And I don't think we're going to see that coming out of Cleveland, but then, you know, you never know.
I'm going to go ahead and predict that the Republican Party does survive. It will look different in any case, but there is so much of the legal infrastructure about elections that's predicated on having two parties named the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And there are so many advantages to being part of a party in terms of finance and the ability to get on the ballot that there will be a Republican Party next year.
All right. All right.
I totally agree.
All right.
But
I
would just add real quickly that part of the story of this election season is the decreasing power of parties because of a lot of structural changes that have happened. And also the changes that have happened in the way in communications and in the power that someone like Trump has to work outside of the organized party. And changes in the way we finance parties and the rise of PACs and all that. That's a big part of the story, too.
Really interesting conversation, Joe Crispino. I'm glad you helped lead us in all of that. When we come back, we've got to take a quick break. But when we come back, we really do need to spend a couple minutes looking at Wisconsin, which comes up on Tuesday. But really, the bad, bad, bad week that Donald Trump has had and whether we think it's going to affect the outcome of upcoming primaries. This is Political Rewind at 3:50.
You told us less is more. So this spring at GPB, we're trying something new. As soon as we hit the goal for our spring membership campaign, we're done. The more listeners we hear from before the drive starts, the sooner we'll get there. Can we cut a day or two off the drive? More? With your contribution now, you'll also enter to win a St. Simons Island getaway for two with three nights at the King and Prince Beach and Golf Resort. Go to gpb.org and click donate. Thanks.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway is at the table. Todd Rehm, Joe Crispino from Emory University, former Democratic congressman from Cobb County, Buddy Darden. Okay, so we all know Donald Trump, I think even Trump supporters would say, not his best week. Let's listen to one of the incidents that really created some problems.
How do you ban abortion? How do you actually do it?
Well, you know, you'll go back to a position like they had where people will perhaps go to illegal places.
Yeah.
But you have to ban it.
You ban it, they go to somebody who flunked out of medical school.
Are you Catholic?
Yes, I think I.
And how do you feel about the Catholic Church's position?
I accept the teaching authority of my church on moral issues.
But do you know their position on abortion?
Yes, I do. But the churches make their moral judgments, but you running for president of the United States will be chief executive of the United States. Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah, there has to be some form.
I don't know. You take positions and everything else.
I do take positions and everything else. It's a very complicated position.
Jim, it seems to me that there were two problems with that. The first and most egregious, obviously, is Trump, who has tried to walk it back ever since, suggesting that women should face some punishment when they have an abortion. The second was, if people watched that interview in its entirety, nobody's pressed him the way Matthews did. And Trump did seem to be making it up as he went along.
I think that tape showed Donald Trump's inexperience at its absolute worst, and I've got to speak carefully here because I don't want to be misunderstood, but Trump fell into the trap of the illogical way in which we discuss abortion. It's very common for opponents of abortion to call abortion murder. It's always expressed in those terms. In the logic of our judicial system, if you murder, then you are complicit, then you get punished. But that's not how we talk about abortion.
Well, it's interesting. Boy, is it not ever, because even the pro-life groups, Todd Rehm, said that they were offended by how Donald Trump expressed himself in that interview.
Well, and during my career, pro-life politics has changed over the last 20 years in Georgia, but one of the things that you learn as either a candidate who's running for office over that period of time, or serving in office, or working for people who do, is you learn the culture of political discussions, and you learn the two or three generally accepted ways of speaking about an issue, and Trump just hadn't had any of that. I had thought early on that one of the things he ought to be doing, and I still think he ought to do this, but it's probably too late, is enroll in a crash course in how to talk about politics. But he had so much success just being Trump that became the mantra, is let Trump be Trump.
Yes, but that's suggesting, isn't it, buddy, that he may not have shown us his true thinking. In other words, yes, it's fine to try to figure out how to parse the issue, but what if he really meant it?
I don't think he really means anything. I think he just says what comes to mind, and he's given the media and he's given his own party structure an opportunity and, frankly, a club to hit him over the head with. And it was kind of, frankly speaking, they're exacting their revenge. Like I said a while ago, the Empire Strikes Back, and they're having a field day with him right now.
And every time I hear somebody give a coherent description of Donald Trump's ideology, I think to myself, they've just put it better than he ever has.
Well, this is the double-edged sword of not speaking like a politician. This is what his supporters love about him, is he's not a politician. He tells it like it is. He speaks from his heart, right? Just like that clip you showed from George Wallace. That's what people loved about George Wallace. But this is the downside, is when you don't speak like a politician, you can also end up sounding like a fool.
Can I say one thing in defense of Donald Trump, however? I think the incident in which the young woman was supposedly assaulted really is rather ridiculous, because I've been in those rushes before. And my wife, back in 1983 one time, was walking along with me, and someone turned and hit her with the side of a TV camera and almost knocked her down. So what I'm saying is, in this kind of confusion and this rush going on, I think perhaps that's a bum rap.
I said it on Wednesday. I'll say it again here. In a different context, the cover-up is worse than the crime. They could have just apologized for the whole incident. Trump could have said, gee, we hate to see this happen. Let's move on. But no, he doubled down. So that's why he's really under fire, I think, over that.
Yeah, and what is it? He's running third in Wisconsin right now?
And that's right. And this is even before the abortion comments in the interview with Chris Matthews on MSNBC Wednesday night. So he loses, really could come in third in Wisconsin. That's devastating to him in terms of his long record of victories since Iowa.
And it gives an important boost to John Kasich. It guarantees that he will stay in the race till the end. And then what it does, of course, it puts extreme importance on New York and other states to vote on the 26th.
We should say, because we're not going to have a whole lot of time to talk about it, Bernie Sanders is now looking as though he could possibly pick off Wisconsin against Hillary Clinton. And he's determined, he's trying to get her into a debate in New York. Buddy, this race, the delegates may be in her corner, but this race is not settled, is it?
No, it's not settled, and I'm beginning to worry about my friend Hillary. In fact, and she is my friend, and I do support her, but she's gotten a little testy lately, and I think she's got to get back in there and smile and maintain the course and just remember, keep your eye on the prize, Hillary.
If you are listening to this show and you are a woman, that was Buddy Darden who said those things, not any of the rest of us at this table. Look, we're completely out of time for today's show. But my thanks to Buddy Darden, to Todd Rehm, as always, to Jim Galloway. Joe Crispino, what a pleasure to have you here. You have to come back and talk politics with us again.
It's a delight being here.
Moving
thanks.
Forward during the campaign. Speaking of women and the election, we're going to do something I'm really excited about. Next Wednesday, we have a panel of women insiders. Jackie Cushman, who you hear on the show with some regularity, will be here. But Julianne Thompson, who has been very involved in the Tea Party movement over the last few years in Georgia, will also be here. Andra Gillespie will join us. And one of the things we're going to try to do is break down where women are headed. Not as if they are a unified voting bloc, but we're going to talk about the issues and how they're playing out for women. So I hope you'll join us next Wednesday at 2 o'clock. We'll also, of course, take a look at what happened the night before in Wisconsin. So that's it for Political Rewind today. As usual, you can listen to our show on the gpb.org website or download the podcast on iTunes if you miss us when we're on the radio. I'm Bill Nigut. I hope you have a terrific weekend. We'll see you next Wednesday for another Political Rewind.